Welcome to Appaloosa Radio, where stories come alive. Appaloosa Radio is a service of the Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater. Rubber Stamps. Jody Carnes Hart. I have recently retired from my position as the Chief Technology Officer for a large California state agency. When I first arrived, the agency was still taking its phone messages on the ubiquitous ping while you were out, Pats. If you remember those times, you will remember that a person, usually a secretary or office assistant, would answer the incoming phone call, attempt to transfer it to the appropriate recipient, and then, if there were no answer, would say, "May I take a message?" Once the message had been written down, someone would walk the message over to the recipient's desk and tape it, with scotch tape, to their chair, where the message would be easy to notice. I once had a boss who, after handling a call from a ping pad, would smear the note on a large spike he had on his desk. I remember seeing a spike that was over a foot tall, completely full, holding many previously smeared messages. He kept the old messages on the smear in case he would have to make a follow-up call to the same individual. At the agency where I worked, it was my job to move an organization with 4,000 permanent employees from ping pads to an integrated and tightly networked state-of-the-art voice data web video assemblage of information systems. I saw a lot of technological change in my 32 years of professional service. In my retirement, I have had time to muse about the philosophy of technology. However, I am not interested in ruminating on potential technological changes in some future world. This will not be a work of science fiction. Sorry, Isaac Asimov and Gene Roddenberry fans. Rather, it will be about a more mundane set of technologies, a set that impacted me very directly. It was a group of technologies that shaped my mother's life. Before I begin, I want to share something of my own professional history. I graduated from UCLA as an accounting major and was hired at a Big Three accounting firm. As I was beginning my graduate program, one of my professors casually asked, "Do you know Fortran?" "Know Fortran?" I did not even know what it was. Later that same week, I received a catalog from our local community college and I noticed they offered a one-semester course in the programming language Fortran. I decided to sign up. Nothing could have changed my life more. Learning Fortran opened many more career paths than accounting did. The most important thing I learned was not the programming language itself, it is a useful tool that can be applied in many different situations. However, the most important thing I learned was how data must be structured and organized for the language to work. Input is many times more important than output, and random junk never works. Structure, structure, structure. However, Fortran was an artificial language, a set of carefully specified instructions. Life, on the other hand, is a plethora of random events. There are no carefully specified instructions that lead to a precisely defined outcome. My career path changed because one afternoon I browsed through a mass mail college catalog. I usually throw such things away without even looking at them. My professor's casual comment had provoked an interest, but not really a strong one. I was simply curious what this thing was. It was not a major commitment. My Thursday evenings were free, and the $46 fee was reasonable. A random event followed by a random event. Not that different from my own mother's life. Let's begin her story when my mother was 16. Josie had always been the very best student in her class, skipping two full elementary grades, and her teachers had forecast considerable success for her. However, during the worst days of the Depression, with her father on permanent disability because of a spinal injury, she quit high school to work for the enormous Montgomery Ward's distribution facility in neighboring Kansas City, Missouri. She later told me that she had quit high school because one winter day, while she was walking across the KC Viaduct, a gust of wind blew up her dress, showing her classmates that she was wearing a slip made of discarded flour sacks. She could not take the social humiliation. Going to work at the Ward's distribution facility brought her a regular salary and opportunities for advancement. Within 2 years, she had one of the best jobs in the warehouse. She was a final checker, determining that a customer's order had been properly fulfilled. She also checked to make certain that the customer's payment had been correct. Once Josie stamped her approval on an order, it went to typists who typed the address label, and then on to the boxers who boxed the order for shipment. Within hours, it would be on a train bound for its destination. Josie generally liked working for Montgomery Ward's. She could shop at a discount in the retail shop, she could eat lunch, also for a discount, in the company's cafeteria, and she was given a company card that let her ride the KC streetcars for free. She said that in general her bosses were okay. Only a couple of real jackasses, she once confided. The Kansas City Distribution Center was one of seven similar locations designed to cover the country. The Montgomery Ward and Company was headquartered in Chicago in a building covering over a quarter mile along the Chicago River. However, no one in the company called it headquarters. Instead, it was always the catalog house. The name reflected the principal technological innovation on which the company was built. Montgomery Ward and Company was built on the mail order catalog. Its founder, Aaron Montgomery Ward, was an American pioneer in selling directly to the end customer through wish book catalogs. All a customer had to do was to lick one postage stamp, and anything anyone could ever want came directly to them. Spittoons, books of gospel hymns, hat pins, bonnets, rifles, wagons, violins, bird cages, bathtubs, windmills, clothes for every member of the family. Today, the mail order catalog hardly seems revolutionary, but in the 1870s, it was. The country was still primarily rural, and farming was the primary industry. In most places, if someone needed something, they drove their wagons to the nearest general store where selection was limited, and prices were often artificially high. Companies which manufactured products sold primarily to wholesale jobbers who, in turn, sold to the local general stores, who finally sold to the local customer. Ward himself had been an extremely successful traveling salesman who sold dry goods to various wholesalers in the post-Civil War South. He often used picture catalogs to represent his wares. Ward observed that this system worked reasonably well for folks who lived in larger cities where there were often multiple merchants. But it worked poorly, or not at all, in the rural areas. Ward saw that a pair of wool trousers he sold to a wholesaler for 50 cents would eventually be sold retail in a general store to a customer for $5. He also noticed that the local general stores often sold on credit, charging the customers usurious interest for the convenience. I'll settle up when my crops come in. Aaron Montgomery Ward saw an opportunity. He invested $1,800, printing his first mail order catalog, which he mailed it to 5,000 individual customers. It featured 172 items, had no pictures, and required cash payment with the order. Still, those $5 wool trousers were only $2.50. Customers responded enthusiastically. That initial catalog produced nearly $100,000 in sales. However, the mail order catalogs were an abomination to the local merchants and the wholesale jobbers that Ward used to sell to. The next time he mailed his catalogs, they intercepted and burned them. He printed and mailed another set, but again many were trashed before they could reach the final customers. Ward asked for government assistance, and, concerned, the U.S. government intervened. By 1906, Montgomery Ward and Company was annually mailing over 3 million of its catalogs, and the catalogs had grown to 240 pages. The company had annual revenue of nearly $9 million. There is no record of how many local general stores either closed permanently or suffered serious revenue losses because of the Montgomery Ward catalogs. It was hard for them to compete on selection, price, and dependability. Since Ward had instituted a satisfaction guaranteed or your money back policy with his earliest catalogs, customers did not need to look him directly in the eye to trust him. How does one prepare a 3-pound, mail-order catalog with over 8,000 individual illustrations? The answer is with lots of very skilled employees. Some estimate that it required about 2,500 employees to create each year's catalog, and the employees had specific job titles including copywriters, illustrators, editors, photographers, linotype operators, composter, pressmen, and collators. One direct impact of the Montgomery Ward Catalog House was that Chicago became a printer city where the skilled labor and equipment were available to produce high-quality, high-volume printed materials, including magazines, catalogs, and books. Chicago became a center for printing college textbooks, maps, and Bibles. 95% of the nation's phone books were printed in Chicago. Some of the world's largest printing firms had their headquarters in Chicago, including Rand McNally, M.A. Donahue and Company, R.R. Donnelly and Sons, and the W.F. Hall Printing Company. Manufacturing printing presses also became a major Chicago industry. Miehl, Goss, and Regensteiner printing presses were all engineered and built in Chicago. It was in Chicago that air-pulsed sheet feeders were first developed, where the massive web presses for continuous feed newspaper printing were conceived and perfected, and where multicolor offset presses first were envisioned and created. Barnhart Brothers and Spindler created hundreds of typefaces that are still in popular use today. The Ludlow typographic system of typing into hot lead was developed to replace the handset techniques that had begun with Gutenberg. At its peak, just before World War I, the Chicago printing industry had over 30,000 active printers, third in the world, behind London and New York. This industry owed its growth in no small part to the Ward's annual mail order catalogs. The mail order catalog was just part of the Montgomery Ward technological story. The Montgomery Ward and Company forged an unrivaled system for efficient, mass distribution of goods through the country's rail network. When my mother worked for the company in the mid-1930s, it prided itself on being able to ship a customer's order in less than 4 hours after the customer's envelope with the order had been opened. That is, 1. The customer's envelope had been opened, its cash counted and deposited in the vaults. 2. The original order been copied onto jobber orders identifying the location of the objects ordered within the massive warehouse. 3. The jobber order placed in a metal basket and then rolled along a steel roller belt to the locations where the individual items were housed in the warehouse. 4. At each designated warehouse location, the necessary item was placed into the metal basket. 5. When the order was complete, it was sent for final check, my mother's job. 6. A mailing label was typed. 7. The items were boxed, or wrapped, and labeled. And 8. The boxed item was placed on the correct U.S. Postal Service mail car for final delivery. The Kansas City Distribution Center where my mother, Josie, worked was the largest building west of the Mississippi River. It matched the Pentagon in its overall floor space. It had separate rail yards for train loads of goods coming into the building and for train loads of customer orders going out. By every contemporary measure, it was a facility of unrivaled efficiency with steel roller tracks to move goods, vacuum tubes to swiftly suck containers with papers from floor to floor, and a teletype system that conveyed information almost instantly from Chicago. However, its most innovative feature was its most basic. Every item in the massive warehouse had its own, clearly designated location. Montgomery Ward's assigned each item a unique item number and placed it on a specific shelf identified with that unique number. When a new item was added to the inventory, a location for it would be identified and clearly marked. It would also receive an identifying entry in the company's voluminous card catalog. When an order came into the distribution center, a clerk would go to the card catalog and record the item's specified location on the jobber sheet and then route the steel basket for the order to the appropriate location. The system was meticulously applied to each and every item in the company's inventory. Each had its own bin, each bin was in a particular aisle, on a particular floor of the warehouse. Woe be to the employee who placed an item in a wrong location. The system was not the creation of the company's founder. He was a salesperson, he learned what you needed and then he sold it to you. His special forte was writing copy for the items in his catalogs. However, he was ill-suited for the actual day-to-day operations of the business. He asked his brother-in-law George Thorne to assume responsibility as the firm's general manager. The very first problem that George Thorne faced was the helter-skelter nature of Ward's warehouse system. Inventory was stored in various warehouses, hither and yon, glassware was in one while pots and pans were in yet another. One fortunate result of the Great Chicago Fire was that George Thorne could build a new warehouse from ground up. Thorne spent considerable time studying logistics and even toured that other Chicago model of modern efficiency, P.D. Armour's meatpacking plants, where a live animal entered at one end and exited in a can ready for the grocer's shelves. The steel tracks with rollers in Ward's warehouses came directly from Armour's meatpacking plants. Visiting a French Army quartermaster facility, Thorne noticed that every item had a unique number and its own unique place in the armory. He borrowed card catalogs from visiting college libraries. In 1905, Ward's opened a satellite branch warehouse in Kansas City to take advantage of the lower shipping rates there. Furniture could be shipped to the west for less than from Chicago. After Aaron Ward and George Thorne died, operation of the company passed to Thorne's four sons. They continued their father's heightened emphasis on efficiency, even using stopwatches to determine how an operation can be accomplished most effectively. It was their decision to open the 9 massive regional distribution centers. Kansas City was the first and the largest. One of the key factors in Montgomery Ward and Company's enormous profitability was the authorization for rural free delivery in 1896. The availability of RFD service meant that catalogs and merchandise could reach rural customers directly, since the U.S. mail came to them. However, it also meant that it was cheaper and easier for other firms to enter the mail order catalog business. By 1900, nearly 30 firms were mailing catalogs directly to RFD customers, the most dangerous of which would prove to be Sears, Roebuck, and Company. Some historians have described the long-running competition between Ward's and Sears for retail supremacy as an all-out, no-surrender war. The conflict was indeed intense and fought over a variety of different merchandising terrains. Ward's began with the clear advantage that it had been mailing its catalogs to rural customers for nearly 20 years before Sears arrived. Ward's also had an extremely efficient delivery system, and the trust of a well-established satisfaction guarantee policy. For its part, Sears initially fought with two weapons: A, lower prices, and B, a clear focus on an improved customer experience. Price proved to be a short-lived weapon. Ward's first responded to the lower prices by claiming that it carried superior products. But mail order customers could not tell much difference between the two companies' offerings. Sears chose to primarily offer its own branded merchandise, and Ward's did not. However, the Sears branded products were often manufactured by the same firms that Ward's used. The difference was that Sears specified the product's characteristics in advance, and Ward's accepted its products after they had been designed and manufactured. Since Sears largely paid in advance for its products, it gained a slight price advantage over Ward's. Ward's responded by increasing the efficiency of its warehouse processing systems, and, thus, met Sears directly on price. It was on improved customer experience that Sears won the battle. Some would argue that improved customer experience is not actually a technology. They reserve the term technology for artifacts, objects that can be encountered and engineered. The Miele air pulsed sheet feeding printing presses were examples of technology, but improved customer experience is not. I argue the contrary opinion. The so-called soft technologies, like improved customer experiences, are just as innovative, just as impactful, just as new as engineered artifacts. The change that they generate can be just as dramatic, just as demonstrative, just as real. What Sears did with its mail order catalogs was very different from what Ward's had been doing, and it made Sears the dominant American retailer for nearly a century. Like many innovations, the changes that brought Sears success were not the result of intentional research and design activities. Rather, they emerged from the prior experiences of the particular people who were there at the time. Richard W. Sears was a ne'er-do-well who happened to meet up with a company selling pocket watches. The company had an unsold inventory, and Sears convinced the company's owners that he could sell this surplus inventory through a mail order catalog. Historians have recorded his success as modest. But it was still enough to interest others to partner in the business. For a couple of years, Alva C. Roebuck was Sears' partner, but Sears eventually bought him out. However, with the advent of rural free delivery, the landscape for mail order marketing changed, and many companies rushed to cash in. Richard Sears decided to expand beyond pocket watches. He brought in a new partner, Julius Rosenwald, who owned a group of men's clothing stores. At first, Rosenwald was just a financial partner, but within months, he became Sears and Roebuck's general manager, largely pushing Richard Sears aside. As Rosenwald learned the mail order catalog business, he was struck by how different it was from his own retail stores. In his retail business, a gentleman customer was serviced by a knowledgeable salesman who showed him a variety of materials, styles, and prices, who fitted clothes to the gentleman's body shape and size, and who gave the customer the opportunity to make well-informed choices. The Montgomery Ward's catalog of the era did none of that. Pages were organized by whatever copy fit on the page. Pictures were often crude line drawings, photographs were of poor quality. The catalog was printed on cheap newsprint. There was a short one-page index. Customers could always find an object's shipping weight, but seldom could know an object's size. Rosenwald made a key decision. He would create a mail order catalog that focused on the customer's experience, and in the catalog, he would teach America how to shop. Rosenwald's very first innovation was to rewrite catalog copy in simple, direct, and friendly language. The catalog should welcome the customer, just as a store clerk would. Next, he added a comprehensive index, one that customers could easily use. The index was printed on different colored paper, so it would be easy to find. He added sizing guides and created uniform sizing across clothing items. Customers would learn their own sizes, e.g., a 9 1/2 shoe size, a 14-inch collar, etc., and be able to order exactly what they needed. He created a simple-to-use order form with the address printed right on the top. He simplified the directions for placing an order, requesting an exchange or return, and how to locate items during the shipping process. He reduced the number of items crammed on a page, adding white space and creating a simple, linear design. He began describing items in simple, informal prose, instead of Ward's flowery, neo-poetic style. He used high-quality, coated paper instead of cheap newsprint. He used a clean and clear typeface and he used it consistently throughout the catalog. One change that Rosenwald implemented came, humorously, from an advertising campaign that Ward's had used against Sears. Ward's printed a three-column advertisement describing an item that both Ward's and Sears had for sale. Above the rightmost column was the word best. The best was the item that Ward's sold. The next column carried the word good and it described an item sold by another company, not Sears. Finally, there was a column with worst which was said to be the item as sold by Sears. This attempt to demean became in the Sears catalogs a regular feature, designed to assist the customer in making informed choices. Instead of best, good, worst, the Sears catalogs featured best, better, good comparisons describing three separate product levels that Sears was selling. A good product had the lowest price and was a solid, well-made product. A better product had extra features that the good product did not. A best product had superior reliability and had many additional features. The Sears catalog not only taught customers the crucial differences between different levels of products, but they also provided opportunities to self-segment the market. That is, customers could themselves choose which level of product most matched their own needs and wants. Rosenwald believed that one of the keys to customer satisfaction was in providing choice. The older Ward's catalog had provided one alternative. Customers had to accept what was offered. Additionally, instead of having just one massive catalog with 25,000 items, Sears produced specialty catalogs for targeted audiences. Catalogs for mechanics. Catalogs of spring dresses for women. Catalogs with only toys. Sears also changed the focus of its catalogs. Whereas the earlier Ward's catalogs had been directed to farmers and had, as a result, a rural, masculine feel, Sears refocused its catalogs toward women. The first 75 pages of the Sears catalog featured women and children's clothing, while tools and farm machinery were moved to the back. When multicolor offset printing became cost-effective for catalogs, Sears used its color pages in the front of the catalog to display photographs of nicer women's clothing, often showing both the front and the back of a dress. None of these innovations were revolutionary in and of themselves, and they were gradually implemented over an extended time frame, but taken together, the continuing emphasis on improving the customer experience permitted Sears to pull significantly ahead of its older rival. My mother, Josie, did not know it, but in 1934, she was hired because she represented cheap labor and Montgomery Ward's needed to drastically reduce its labor costs. I now believe that 16-year-old girls were hired to replace long-term Ward's employees, some of whom may have worked for the company for as long as 30 years. Unlike its competitor Sears, Ward's had a reputation of being fair to its employees. As early as 1912, Ward's offered, free of charge, the so-called Equitable Life Assurance package of benefits to any employee who had worked for the company continuously for 10 years. The insurance package included disability insurance, health insurance, and retirement benefits. The company contributed the equivalent of 2% of an employee's salary to fund the insurance payments. As a direct result, Ward's had many employees who had worked for the company for more than 20 years. However, the company began to lose money well before the Depression during the late 1920s. Its original market, rural farmers, had changed considerably since the first wish books were published. Farm machinery had reduced the farm labor needed to plant and harvest crops. Many of the doughboys who had fought in World War I chose not to return to the family's farm, but to work in an urban factory instead. Extended droughts had created dust bowl conditions across much of the Midwest, and the notorious boll weevil had brought havoc to the southern cotton farms. Large-scale factory, corporate, farms were replacing the older family farms in places like California. Sears, on the other hand, had moved well beyond its original rural markets into other areas of profitability. Managing this move was retired Army General Robert E. Wood. During World War I, General Wood had been the Army quartermaster who had overseen logistical operations for the American military during the war. As soon as General Wood retired, the four Thorne brothers who still owned Ward's hired him. They were always looking for ways to improve the efficiency of their warehouse system. One of the first things that General Wood recommended was for Ward's to become a publicly traded stock company, which made generating new capital considerably easier. Grudgingly, the Thorne brothers agreed, but they retained most of the stock themselves, limiting the effectiveness of the strategy. However, it was what General Wood proposed doing with the new capital that really disturbed the Thorne brothers. General Wood proposed leaving the mail order business and building stores instead. He argued that the automobile had changed retailing. Americans were now driving their cars to buy groceries at supermarkets. They would also gladly drive their cars to department stores to buy quality goods at reasonable prices. Rural farmers now had cars. There was no need for a business aimed solely at farms on the dusty end of the road. So, a year and a half after he had been hired, General Robert Wood was fired by Montgomery Ward's. Within 3 months of his firing, he was at Sears as a senior vice president, and the upper management at Sears loved the idea of expanding its retail operations to stores. Wood did not want to locate his new Sears department stores downtown, where most of the other department stores were always located. Instead, he chose more suburban locations where he could have ample free parking for his patrons. In 1929, just before the October stock market crash and the beginning of the Depression, Sears celebrated the opening of its 300th department store. Nearly 70% of its sales came from its retail stores. The famed Sears Book of Bargains catalog continued to generate profits, but not always from mail order sales. The catalog was connected to telephone exchanges where customers could call up and place their order over the phone. Sears also made profits from its automobile insurance company, Allstate, its international sales, and its very successful credit divisions. As the Depression continued and economic conditions worsened, General Wood, now the president of Sears, approached Montgomery Ward's about a possible merger. Aghast, the Thorne brothers refused. They would have nothing to do with a traitor. In 1931, Montgomery Ward approached its New York bankers about financing for the coming catalog year. When the financiers looked at the company's fiscal records, they concluded that it was fast approaching bankruptcy. The bondholders acted quickly, ousting the Thorne brothers, and installing a hard-nosed thug as the company's new president. Sewell Avery came from the building products industry, where he had built U.S. Gypsum into the dominant player in its sector. He knew nothing about catalog sales, but he knew how to break labor and to bring profitability. One of Avery's very first acts was to cancel the Equitable Assurance Program. Next, he tore through the company, eliminating managerial staff and longtime employees. He replaced catalog managers with managers with retail store experience, poaching them from companies like JCPenney's and Woolworths. Sewell Avery wanted department stores just like Sears, and he wanted them now. Ward's already had a network of over 500 stores, but they were catalog stores, primarily where customers could check out items like kitchen appliances. Sears stores, on the other hand, featured very different merchandise than its catalogs. Sears devoted a full third of its floor space to women's clothes, none of which were offered in the catalog. It featured nice, but not extravagant items, things a suburban housewife would wear or use. But that would not break the family's bank account. Staff in the Sears stores were thoroughly trained and were expected to act in the Sears way, courteous, calm, attentive, but not smothering, knowledgeable, but not assertive. Stores were clean, brightly lit, and easy to walk through. Of course, the parking lot was always just outside the store's doors. Meanwhile at Ward's, my mother, Josie, was smart, hardworking, and willing to do whatever she was asked. It did not occur to her that Sewell Avery was exploiting her, paying her a third of what previous employees had made. It was the Depression and she had a job. She was also the prime breadwinner in her family, they needed her income. She did not complain when Avery eliminated her free trolley fare, the employees' cafeteria, and all discounts at the company's retail store. Some see the Sewell Avery time as a black period for Montgomery Wards. However, I never heard my mother complain about it. And Avery finally squeezed the company back into marginal profitability. To his credit, Sewell Avery did get his retail stores, just like Sears, suburban stores with lots of free parking, and merchandise that was different, maybe not better, than what was sold in the catalog. However, no one ever described the Montgomery Ward stores as innovative or exciting. No, they are best described as blah, just plain blah. They sold stuff, not the best stuff, not the worst stuff. The company tried to generate interest with its Wendy Ward character, who was supposed to be a suburban housewife who really used the really wonderful Ward's products, but she did not stay around too long. The one big success that happened during the Sewell Avery years was a story that a Ward's copywriter created. He called it Rudolph, the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The storybook was given free to every child who visited Santa in a Ward store toyland during the 1939 Christmas season. That year, the lines to see Santa were extremely long and Ward sold completely out of toys. Rudolph gained Christmas immortality when Johnny Marks wrote a song that Gene Autry recorded. Unfortunately, Rudolph was a one-time event. The Sewell Avery era ended ignobly when he picked a needless fight with the United States government during World War II. Franklin Roosevelt believed the country needed Wards to be a necessary supplier of wartime goods. Sewell Avery refused to cooperate. He spent an obscene fortune on lawyers opposing the request. Finally, FDR had enough. He nationalized the company and removed Sewell Avery. After the war, Wards returned to private ownership and the company continued to be profitable, but uninteresting. Its story basically ended when a corporate raider bought and ransacked it, after which it went through a variety of corporate owners, and eventually collapsed. In January 1942, my mother, Josie, quit her job at Montgomery Wards to marry my father, then a sergeant in the Army Air Corps. She traveled by train to Fort Leavenworth and they were married in the base chapel. They had only 2 weeks together before my father received his orders. He was dispatched to Fort Dix in New Jersey to learn a new top secret technology. She would not see him again until after the war. The technology that my father was sent to Fort Dix to learn was so top secret that he could not discuss it until a decade after his discharge. He was trained to install and maintain radio-controlled, remote-sensing weather stations. He installed hundreds of them all over the Indian subcontinent, in China, and in Southeast Asia. These remote weather stations provided real-time weather information to the British American Meteorological Team based in Delhi, India. On a radio signal from the base, the remote weather station would transmit back, on a designated frequency, its current weather information. During the war, all weather information was secret, and this remote sensing system was classified as top secret. My father's assignment involved real danger. Most often he would be flown into a primitive jungle airfield on a DC-3 aircraft, but several times he was forced to parachute in. Two of the other technicians in his unit died in crashes over Burma. While my father was in India on his top secret assignment, my mother, Josie, decided to follow her sister to Seattle. Josie's sister had come to Seattle because her own husband, who was an Army air traffic controller, had sailed from there to counteract the Japanese invasion of the Aleutians. Once in Seattle, Josie's sister decided to stay. She spent the war working on the Boeing aircraft assembly line. In Seattle, Josie saw an ad for a bookkeeping position, and she applied for it. The company owned a 57-mile railroad and a collection of coal mines, just inland from the central Washington coast. The company's owners were a very conservative Norwegian family, and the company had never had a female employee. Still, it was wartime and all three of the company's bookkeepers had been drafted. They decided to give the girl a try. 2 days after they had hired her, Josie came to the owners with what seemed like a strange request. She requested that they spend $125 to purchase an electric 10-key adding machine. She wanted a model that printed on paper tape, and that also had subtraction and multiplication functions. I am not sure how she learned about 10-key adding machines. They were at the time very state-of-the-art. But, she knew she wanted one and she knew exactly what model and manufacturer. She wanted an Underwood Sundstrand. To her surprise, the crusty Norwegian patriarch agreed. Within a week, she had her Underwood Sundstrand busy adding columns and subtracting numbers, computing rates, and confirming calculations with its ever-dependable paper tape. Josie and her Underwood Sundstrand proved a wise investment for the company. It was wartime and railroads had innumerable government forms to fill out. Josie proved a whiz at forms. The price of coal was tightly controlled. Josie ensured that the company always met the price requirements. She always had the necessary documentation should a government inspector ask. It would be accurate to say that Josie not only matched the performance of the previous three male bookkeepers, but in many ways exceeded it. Many years later, she told me that the happiest time of her life was when she worked for the Norwegian family's railroad. She said she felt valued, needed, and appreciated. And, she liked the view from her office window. The company's offices were on the 32nd floor of the Smith Tower, the tallest building in Seattle until the Space Needle was finished in 1962. She loved riding up in the elevators, looking out the glass doors as the elevator operators navigated the complex array of buttons. She also loved looking up at the building at night from ground level, up at the pointed glass dome with its ubiquitous blue lights. Seattle's rain never bothered her. She could always wear her fashionable dresses under her raincoat. After leaving Seattle, she would have other jobs as a bookkeeper, but none brought the satisfaction of the war years. I always thought she was terrific with numbers, the fastest person I knew on a 10-key adding machine.